Today's podcast features the second part of our conversation between JFY Executive Director Gary Kaplan and Kevin McCaskill, the Executive Director of Madison Park Technical Vocational High School, the only vocational high school in the Boston Public School System. Mr. McCaskill has been working in education for over 30 years. And between them, Gary and Mr. McCaskill have close to 75 years of experience advocating for public education. In this episode, we'll hear how the current pandemic exposed a lack of access to technology for some Boston families.
I'm during this pandemic, especially here in Boston, just using Boston as the litmus test. I mean, how many families couldn't, you know, they didn't have their own pieces of technology, let alone the internet services. So now your child is getting further and further and further behind.
How progress and change continues to work its way across the country.
But they're galvanizing for change, and not change for a takeover, for the betterment of our country.
And what is the most important aspect of leadership in our schools to ensure they provide the best possible education to our students?
You have to have the will to do it. And that's always rhetorical. Because everyone can say they have the will, but who really has the gumption and the grit and the will to move things forward?
This podcast was created by JFY Networks, a Boston-based nonprofit provider of online learning programs to schools, students, and parents. JFY's individualized self-paced curricula help raise individual and school performance measures by maintaining grade-level skills and combating learning loss. JFY provides online ELA and math curricula aligned to state and college standards from grade 6 through high school, with personal support online and via telephone from friendly learning specialists like yours truly. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. In part two of our conversation with Mr. McCaskill, Gary begins by noting how the issues of inequality in technology have been intertwined for the past 40 years.
Well, Kevin, we had a great discussion last time, and we got off some really good ideas. And we touched on the subject of inequality and technology just for about a page and a half last time. But then we, of course, you know, it was about midnight. We ran out of steam.
Absolutely.
Let me just kind of get into it like this. The last 40 years, the age of technology is about 40 years, 1980. And that is also the inflection point after which inequality really skyrocketed in this country and pretty much around the world. And of course, technology contributed to that. So far for the past 40 years, the whole age of the digital age, I guess you could say, what technology has done is it has exacerbated inequality. Technology is great for the haves and is not so great for the have-nots, and it has contributed to the great split in which, you know, 1% of the Western Europe and North American population control whatever it is, 90% of the wealth. Silicon Valley, you know, is obviously about as white as it gets, and you know, it's also about as male as it gets. But that's not our problem today. So, you know, if you think about how the development of technology has contributed to the increase in inequality, how, and of course, technology is not going away. We're not going to go back to whatever the heck it was before 1980. So technology is here. It's going to continue infiltrating every nook and cranny of our lives. Do you see it, that whole force continuing to be basically whites only and affluent only? Or is there a way that technology could kind of change course and turn into a force for greater equality rather than what has been so far, which is a strong force for inequality?
Well, without the claim of being called a socialist, which I'm not, I think, you know, when we talk about, you know, I see this as on the same lines, Gary, is healthcare. It's funny how Europe and Canada have figured out healthcare. They figured it out.
Yeah.
Yet you come here, it's a problem. The same thing with tech. The same thing can be said for technology. I mean, when we look at just internet service, respective, you know, from a suburban perspective to an urban perspective to even a rural perspective, which I think gets left out of the mix quite a bit as well. And what is access? Access is a necessity these days. It's not something like, you know, where it's a privilege that, no, it's a necessity. Yeah. People have to be wired to see what's going on in the world around them.
Yeah.
I mean, case in point, how many during this pandemic, especially here in Boston, just using Boston as the litmus test. I mean, how many families couldn't, you know, they didn't have their own pieces of technology, let alone the internet services. So now your child is getting further and further and further behind. Whereas you don't, that's not an issue in Wellesley. It's not an issue in Natick or Needham or Newton or all the surrounding area. That's not an issue. It's about how fast can we get the information?
Yeah.
And even if they do have it, what's the speed on the internet? I mean, these are all factors in it.
Yeah.
And these are important things that most folks will just brush off to the side. But yet we see it as a continuation of, as you indicated, Gary, creating a larger gap. And so where do you go? Families, that's why families turn to schools. They turn to schools to get this access. During the hours between 7 o'clock and 4 or 5 o'clock, they've got access. They've got a reasonable speed of internet service. They can ask for support if they need it.
Yeah.
Whereas at home, decisions are, and we always hear that old adage, well, people have to prioritize. Well, yeah, if you're making minimum wage, you have to prioritize between keeping the lights on or having the internet. So what's the toss up? Having food or having the internet?
Yeah.
I mean, these are decisions folks shouldn't have to make. But yet, as you said, it continues to widen. And I wish I had the answers. I think if I had the answers, I'd be on a podium someplace here in the country. But, you know, it's something in which all parties, and including, and I'm not talking politics when I say parties, I'm talking about sectors of society, schools, health agencies, social agencies, even politicians, you know, philanthropic organizations. How do we come together to solve this issue? And until we come to that modality and that approach to solving this issue, Gary, it's just going to keep exacerbating itself on and on. And again, the pandemic has done us no favors in this. And the question becomes, when we do come back, hopefully, you know, in a reasonable amount of time, what are we going to do? Because the same issue is going to persist.
You know, I would say the pandemic has done us a favor because it's revealed all this stuff.
Great point.
You know, nobody even thought about, you know, do all these urban kids have any technology at home? Nobody thought about that before. And now all of a sudden it's bubbled up and now everybody knows about that particular digital divide.
And with technology, you know, again, and believe me, I am as low tech as anybody.
No. I never claim
to be someone who is an expert in this field, but I do know one thing. I know the technology changes, you know, very rapidly, very quickly.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas what's in one year may not be the rave the next. And everyone's always going for bigger, better, and faster each and every year. And I know in schools, we never keep up.
No.
So can you imagine in these multi-million dollar monopolies we call school districts, if they can't keep up, can you think about these individual homes trying to keep up?
Yeah. Well, and even within the schools, you know, certain districts like Newton and Wellesley and so forth, they do pretty well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when we get back to Boston, Worcester, Springfield and so forth, the money isn't there.
Yeah. You know, and it's not and this is by no means to slap the suburbs. Hey, if you have the means, by all means, make everything accessible for you and your family. But it's to the point where, and you brought up, you know, Springfield. Springfield is, you know, obviously, you know, I believe it's the third largest city here in Massachusetts.
It is.
But compared to Worcester and Boston, there's a considerable income gap
Oh, yeah.
And so now you're looking at an extremely poor city.
Yeah.
With literally no means. How do those families, how do those families make it? It's just, it's sad. And Gary, as you know, we said in the last, I lived in Springfield for 30 years, and I was very fortunate to have, you know, viable means of employment as well as income. But I think about all those families in Springfield, again, a city that was hard hit, you know, by a lot of factors. What happens to those families? It's just, it makes you wonder. And then, it should move us all to action. Action of how do we galvanize support to find reasonable funds to have a sustainable system where kids have access, literally 24-hour access to technology. Not so much to play video games or surf the net, but geez, just to do their work and to be inquisitive about certain topics, to learn more, to be more informed.
Well, you know, this kind of gets back to the socialism issue. You know, we can't even really agree on healthcare.
That's right.
We're still fighting over that. And so you're going to come along and say, hey, we need a great big spending bill to give technology to all these poor kids in the cities and in small towns.
That's right.
But I just cannot understand how people can not see that by having a whole bunch of poor and under-resourced people in this country, it's not doing them any good. It's a bad situation.
Well, it's madness. You know, you think, you know, you bring up a good point with
what
social
programs. What's the matter with them?
You look at social programs. Go back. You met the Great Depression, I believe it.
When FDR
was president from 33 to 45. I mean, you talk about a master of putting together social programs.
Yeah.
Just to get the country back in kilter during and also not only coming out of the Depression, but during a war. And he put together these social projects for the good of the nation.
But he was lucky because he had the Depression and then he had the war. And, you know, so he had all these tailwinds to and even at that, you know, the Republicans fought him tooth and nail on every single. They tried to declare every part of the New Deal. They tried to eliminate. That's why he tried to pack the Supreme Court.
Yeah,
which he didn't get away with.
But even with I always go back to the Works Project Administration, putting people to work,
clearing land,
building roads,
yeah,
building the infrastructure of the United States. But you know, Gary, fast forward to the late 50s when Sputnik was launched.
Right.
You saw this mad dash from the United States for science.
Right.
I guarantee you, look at that time, you probably have more scientists coming out of the United States during time because of one, we could never be second. But it was never be second. But yet you saw science as a major, major emphasis, and it was a national push.
That's right.
So, you know, when you start doing these things because of someone else doing it, if that's your impetus, it's not going to be sustainable. And that's what we've always done, something that's not sustainable because it's always someone else who we're trying to beat as opposed to doing it for the greater good and the common well of society. When we get to a mindset of doing things for the common well and that we all should be altruistic in everything that we do, we would be a lot better off. But it's always got to be an impetus of being second. Or not getting what I want.
Yeah.
So now I'm going to be competitive or outshining someone as opposed to, look, you know, these folks are in need. What is it that we can build? And we can do a short term where you can throw money at it for the short term, but that's not sustainable. How do we build a network of sustainable systems and structures that are pressure tested and pressure proof and that we can meet just the basic needs of folks to give them a leg up, to propel them to compete in society, compete for industry employment, compete for housing. And those are things, you know, again, you shouldn't be competing for housing. You should be able to live wherever you want to live that you can afford. But if I can't work someplace at a reasonable wage, how can I afford anything?
How can I? Yeah, yeah.
So
I don't understand how people cannot see that helping people earn more money, which they're going to spend.
That's right.
How can you not see that?
Gary, it's greed, you know, selfishness, you know, hate. Let's call it what it is. Literal hate, perceptions of things that they think they know and they really don't. It's just a matter. We talk about this country, and again, I wouldn't live anyplace else. But we always talk about the beauty of diversity. Yeah, diversity is great. It's a great thing. But when we're not, well, how come it doesn't work in certain sectors of our society where it's not okay to be diverse? And these are things that, you know, I go back to the, I can recall my my grandmother who passed almost 20 years ago. And, you know, she was always, you know, every now and then she was from the South. And, you know, I think one day I asked her, do you think we ever see a black president? And she said, not in my lifetime. And so, you know, she passed away in 2002.
So she just missed it.
You know, and I'm looking at it and I can recall this conversation that we had fast forward 6 years. And I had the same feelings that maybe my kids would see that in their lifetime.
Yeah.
And sure enough, it happens. And the question becomes, here it is, you know, 80 years in the making. It took, you know, plus an additional 80 some odd years, you know, during my grandmother's time that she didn't see. But yet here it is, you know, I was in my 50s, and here it is.
Yeah, here it is.
And so the question becomes, is that progress? Well, if one makes it, that you can see this progress, but what happens on a much smaller scale? When do we start seeing cities such as Boston have a black or brown mayor? When do you see it? Yes, you know, we've got a city council that's, oh God, it's the most diverse in the history of Boston.
Yes.
People of color and women. That is fantastic. You have a black commissioner, a police commissioner. It's fantastic. You have a black DA, district attorney, Suffolk County. But the question becomes with leadership really starts at the top. So when does that change, especially with the changing demographics of our city?
Yeah.
Same thing can be said in Worcester. Same thing can be said in Springfield. You know, because it seems like New England, you know, when I look at these, when I look at these Massachusetts, Massachusetts is literally behind the times because everyone else in a major city has had this.
Yeah.
And yet it hasn't occurred here.
Well, you know, Obama himself in his book says that he thinks that his election actually pushed the whole reaction, the whole white supremacy reaction.
You know, one of the defining moments that I think really epitomizes that very point, Gary, Obama was addressing the Senate. And I think it was Joe Wilson. He was a senator from, where was he from, Virginia?
Yeah. I don't remember where he's from, but I remember.
You know, what state he's from, but had the audacity to stand up to a sitting president and yell at the top, "You lie."
Yeah.
Gary, what do you think would have occurred? And I'm going back to LBJ. What would have happened if somebody just stood up and told LBJ, "You're a liar"? They would have put it this way. He would have been on the first thing smoking someplace out of there. Could you picture someone doing that to Ronald Reagan?
No, of course not.
How about even as much as they despise Bill Clinton, they wouldn't do that to Bill Clinton?
No.
But yet this guy felt empowered and emboldened enough and privileged enough to call a sitting president, the leader of the free world, to call him a liar in front of millions of folks. You know, and that still resonates with it to this day. That still resonates with me. Gary, it ties right into when you feel that you are in a position
where
you can talk any way you want to anyone and feel that there's no repercussions of it, you're going to continue to do it. And it's the same thing when let's bring it back to technology or income or positions of employment. And you thought about Silicon Valley. Well, see, when you have young children where there is no legislation of having them being armed with capable internet and computers and laptops, when you don't have that, you become a very, very segregated society. And it goes back and they figure they make the laws. They can circumvent them whenever they want to.
Yeah.
And it becomes a very exclusive club. And so when someone is trying to say, hey, that's not right, now let's build a wall around our club, and now it's exclusive because we'll take only the token ones who agree with what we say and who will follow what we say and be the mouthpiece of saying, see, all black and brown people don't think like those people outside of our group. It's a sad commentary about, again, society. And again, I think, as I stated before, I wouldn't live anyplace else. I believe in a free society. I believe in capitalism and all the pieces that go along with it. But it's funny how when we look about, especially in this socially and racially charged era that we're in, I mean, much more than the 50s and the 60s right now, you're seeing the civil rights, the civil rights movement 2.0. You are seeing it right in front of your eyes. And I think it's in its time. And it's great when I hear, and I'll just bring it right to Roxbury. You know, sitting here in my office, especially during some of the protests, to see some of these white kids that were getting off at Roxbury Crossing, and not one or two, but I'm talking hundreds, coming into Roxbury to support the cause.
Uh-huh.
To support the cause. See, that's a unifying piece. And it's not the destruction of society.
Yeah.
It's not the end of days. People are just saying, this isn't right, and we're not tolerating this anymore. We're going to keep coming out here night after night, week after week, until we see a semblance or just some resemblance of equity.
Yeah.
And you can't be scared if your thought process was a little jaded. Okay. There's no one on this earth who sits on the right hand of God. You know, we may have some people who profess that they do, but there is no one here that sits on the right hand. So we are not perfect beings.
Yeah.
And when we start identifying some of the faults, some of the blind spots that we have, and just saying, hey, I can help you with that, just like you can help me with this. Those are just great unifying pieces. And it's fantastic to see. And everyone's, well, it's all got to be Democrats. No, it's just some good independent folks who are out there, and actually some good Republican folks who understand what is right and what is wrong and what is equitable and what is not equitable. We keep being exposed to these extreme cases in which they are just flat out saying, this is our country. This is how we used to do it, and we're going to continue to do it this way. It's an extreme. But for the most part, but see, Gary, you can't stop evolution. And the evolution is, you see it, the populations of black and brown folks every single year is increasing. Sure. And it's just, and I see certain sectors of white Americans trying to hold on.
Oh, sure.
It's not a matter, no one wants to take what you have. Hey, this is all our country. Let's all work collaboratively to make it the best possible place where we can earn a living, raise a family, and be benevolent towards one another. That's what this was about.
Well, one somewhat encouraging development is that Trump's save the suburbs argument apparently didn't work. The white suburban women did not buy his claim that he was saving them from you know what.
I mean, you just had individuals that just saw that they look, that's not who we are. You know, I think that resonated loud and clear. This is not who we are. We are not the evil individuals who want to build walls and set up obstacles and be the defiant ones in which we're going to keep folks out.
And yet, 70 million people.
They
voted for the guy.
But you know, it's something again. But more folks, voted the other way. Where when you start galvanizing, and I look at folks like Stacey Abrams and the work she did down in Georgia, just getting people, just getting them registered to vote, and I guarantee there's more like her across the board in every single state. But they're galvanizing for change, and not change for a takeover, change for the betterment of our country.
It's it's not it's sharing the wealth a bit more. And nobody, yeah, there's no takeover in the offing. But let's bring it back to Boston.
Yeah.
But before we do that, just one remark. The Fortune 500 companies, what are there, four black CEOs, something like that?
It's a small number.
Yeah, it's a single digit, and I think it's four. I think a couple of years ago it was six, but a couple of them disappeared, and now it's something like four. Fortune 500. Black CEOs, four. So that's nationally. And then, but then, you know, when you come, of course, Boston, it's a little difficult to generalize about Boston because it is such a comparatively white city. You know, it's not Chicago, it's not Philadelphia,
correct,
it's not New York. This is the whitest major metropolitan area around. So there's a structural problem. But, you know, who was that guy? Was it the CEO of Wells Fargo or one of those places that just recently, within the past month or so, was speaking somewhere? And they said, well, how come you don't hire more people of color? And he said, we try, but the talent just isn't there. Remember that?
Yeah, I'm looking at you. You're looking at that. You got to say, but there's a great, there's an article actually on CNN. It was on CNN, and I believe the president of Howard University saw that very piece.
Yeah.
Said, oh, the talent is available. It's, are you looking in the right places for it? And I really put that back to home about what we're trying to do here at Madison Park about preparing young people to be in a position, not that we're going to have CEOs of Fortune 500 companies at age 18 coming out, but how do we really get them into a mindset?
I'd have to wait till they're 20.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, how do we get them into a mindset of,
that's right,
of progressive thinking about this is where I start, but I see the end game in here. I said, if I want to get into management, I know how to get into management. Why?
Yeah.
I know the inner workings of not only my position, but other people's positions. I know how to mobilize people. We learn how to, we develop leaders while they're here in high school. And that's something where we really have to start doing a better job, where I have to put the onus back on us as educators of really building those leaders. Because as you know, everyone's not built to be a leader. I mean,
well,
like what someone may tell you.
Yeah.
If that was the case, we'd never get anything done because everybody's telling everybody what to do and nothing gets done.
But
we've got to start putting people in a position,
yeah,
and offering the offering opportunities in which, you know, they're doing these internships with high level management.
Yeah.
They're going down to some of the HBCUs into these schools of business and management and other fields, where they're going down and they're actually cultivating that talent. That talent is being cultivated, not April of their senior year of college, but you're cultivating that
all the way from the
year
beginning
of college.
Yeah.
You're cultivating that while these kids are in high school, where these companies are really investing the time to build their own, to really be selfish about it, build their own workforce.
Well, of course, there's nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely nothing wrong with that.
That's the whole point, is to seeing all of these folks as an asset and not as a liability or a threat.
Exactly.
And, you know, but I don't know that it's actually happening very much.
When you look at these in Boston, I tell you, there's on the Eastern Seaboard, there really isn't another city like it.
No.
And I'm just talking not with respect to race or I'm talking about with respect to the amount of industry and the amount of money.
Yeah.
Through this city.
Yeah.
The question becomes, what does your internship program look like? And what I mean, just like you can give a kid a summer internship for 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And it's great. And you put it on the company flyer and it makes you look like, it makes like you're doing something. But what are those sustainable systems of that? What does that internship program look like? What do those opportunities look like within those companies of sticking around, monitoring the progress of those interns, seeing that they've got something going on, seeing that there might be a small financial backing of these students because you are grooming them to get into your organization or your company. And this is when you start looking at how many of them actually have this system. And, you know, again, and I could be very naive about it. There may be quite a few existing. I don't know.
I don't think
I don't know the answer.
But, well, you know, look, you would have run into it if it was there.
But you see what happens in our unions when you talk about our trades unions.
Oh, yeah.
The apprenticeship programs.
Yeah.
I mean, there's your feeder. The apprenticeships are your feeders. So there's a constant feeder system. So where is the feeder system to certain of these companies and organizations? Where's your farm system? You know, again, to use a baseball analogy. Where's your farm system?
Yeah.
And this is where you could really do, I think, the greater good of creating that farm system within your high school settings. I know Northeastern has an outstanding internship program, but when I look at the demographics of Northeastern, well, they really don't match the Boston Public Schools demographic. So who's getting those internships? When you start talking about equitable systems, companies should really start be selfish. Plant a flag at a school and say, you know, we're looking for folks to work here. We're looking for folks to work here. This is what we do. And if you do the X, Y, and Z, I can guarantee you employment. And this is how you can really advance yourself. Give you an example of that type of partnership. When I was in, and you're aware of this, Gary, when I was in Springfield with Bay State Health Systems, was a big partner with us.
Yeah.
And they were very up. We are doing this because we want everyone in this allied health program, we want to hire all of them. And this is what we'll invest, the time, talents, and treasures that we'll invest. Because at the end of all of this, they're going to college because we want an educated workforce. And then we're going to pluck them off and we're going to monitor them all throughout, not only high school, but while they're in school as well. Hey, you know what? I'm all for that. And they were very upfront. They were one of the best partners that I've ever, you know, had.
Are they still doing that?
I don't think they are. But that was something that they thought you're in a school that hasn't, at the time, we're about 88% students of color. They said, this is how we can diversify our field and also train individuals to get into the workforce. And and it's not just from a compliance perspective. We are solving multiple problems in one fell swoop.
So there's two big institutional blocks that need to get into the game. One is college. You know, the colleges have to be early college. All of that stuff has to be built in structurally, and business.
True.
Now, you know, so you've made some good moves towards college with all the early college stuff.
Absolutely.
Dual
enrollment in early college has been such a successful venture for here at Madison Park.
Yeah.
You know, everyone will start fight, well, aren't you training them for industry? That doesn't mean you can't be educated as well to get.
You know, I don't understand. That's a whole thing. What do you think industry is? You think it's working in a steel mill? Even in a steel mill now, it's you're sitting at a console controlling, the furnaces. The proportion of the steel industry workforce that has a college degree, you know, used to be something like 13%. And now it's something like 60%.
Yeah.
You know, there is basically no unskilled labor left in the economy, and the degree of skill that you need to do anything is keeps going up. So you can't separate education from workforce development. It's the same thing.
You really can't, and it's great that, you know, we have an opportunity in our VOTECs across the Commonwealth and across the country, in which we can literally train students to leave, you know, exit high school into industry. But yet they've had ample training across a lot of mediums. Yeah. But to say that, you know, well, you're sending too many kids to college. It's nothing wrong with someone being educated and being a carpenter. With someone being a plumber and knowing a little bit about engineering. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, if a child chooses to go right into industry, right from high school, never see college, as long as they can sustain their work over decades and decades of time, fantastic.
But the likelihood is that they won't be able to, because
further,
you know, the higher skills, not technology skills, but also all of that stuff, critical thinking and problem solving. And it's getting to be the value equation has shifted from productivity to creativity. It's not good enough to, okay, I have this set of skills, I do them real well, so that's it, I'm set for life, right?
Yeah.
No, you're set for maybe the next 2 years, and then everything's going to change, and you're going to have to change, and you're going to have to learn a whole bunch of new stuff. So it's really learning how to learn is what you have to be focused on. And that idea that people have said for forever, that voc schools should not be sending kids to college, it's just
if a student comes in, you know, think about the marketability of that one student. You have a marketable skill that someone will pay you to perform, and yet you decide, you make a choice to, hey, I'll advance my knowledge base, and now, you know, go a few years, even if I go 1 year to a technical school, or 2 years to a community college, or to a 4-year school, and I continue to enhance my marketable skill. Can you picture what that individual's worth on the market? But it's on the flip side of that, even if I just come out of high school into an entry level position, and yet I continue to accumulate credentials, industry recognized credentials, that's increased schooling. It literally is increased schooling.
Of course it is.
And so what happens, the person's always improving himself through education. It's not education sitting in a classroom with a book in front of you, but yet it's gaining knowledge in your respective field to not only advance yourself, but advance your organization, advance your status within the company or organization that you're in. It's constant learning. And that's something that I think, you know, comes from VOTEC schools, where your learning has to always be continuous. It can never be a flat line. Once you get out of high school, you don't learn anything else. Well, you're actually regressing after that.
That's right. So looking at the city, you know, where we are, Eastern Massachusetts, the Boston Public Schools, which is kind of the next layer of the sphere, and then Madison Park. So Eastern Mass, a lot of money. Jesus, just, you know, just one point that is just interesting to remember. I've always thought that one of the big things that distinguishes Boston from just about all other major cities is it's both the commercial capital and the political capital. You know, like New York, it's New York City, but Albany or Chicago, Springfield, Philadelphia. What is the capital of that state? Harrisburg. When you split the capital from the commercial center, you dilute the talent pool.
Yeah.
But here, everybody's in the same place, and it's a small town. You know, it's only a 500,000 town. You know, in normal times, like, you know, I used to, you could walk down Washington Street in Downtown Crossing and run into just about everybody in city and state government and in business. I used to see, what was his name? The chairman of Bank of Boston, Chad Gifford. Mm-hmm. I used to see him walking down Washington Street around the corner from our office, licking an ice cream cone all the time. It's a small town,
yeah,
and everybody is right here.
That's right.
You know, and you can walk the whole city in half an hour. That's, you know, that's really something that really contributes to the vitality of Boston. So you got all of this money. You've got the universities, you've got the hospitals, you've got Fidelity, you've got, you know, you've got all of this stuff. And yet it has not turned into greater equity in the city. And then you have the Boston Public Schools, which, have they made progress in the last, the last 20 years? Has there been progress in the Boston Public Schools? I suppose there has been.
I think it has. I think one of the alarming pieces, though, Gary, and it's something, I mean, it's public knowledge. I mean, we're losing students. But when we start having faith, when families start really having faith in the public schools, stop beating up the public schools. And sometimes we need to be smacked around, you know, there's no doubt about that. But really say, this is what a child can get in 13 years of formal public education. This is what they can get. And we, and that has to, and you have to have that thought when that child goes into pre-K, when that child goes into kindergarten. When my child finishes Boston Public Schools, they will have the requisite skills to matriculate into a 2 or 4 year school without remediation, or they can leave because they have the skills and knowledge base as well as credentials to go into an entry level position in one of these high powered industries that Boston has. And that's got to be a belief system coming from starting in elementary school. And not that you're going to tell a five-year-old, you're going to be an engineer one day. Kids looking at you, I don't even know what an engineer is. Is that the guy who, you know, who drives the train? They don't know. But yet when you start infusing these activities, hands-on, project-based, heavy with math and science, with literacy, and be it across the board to our EL students and our special needs students, where you're modifying the same exact material, not lowering the expectation, keeping the same expectation, but simply modifying the curriculum so they can meet it. When we do that on a consistent basis across a number of schools, you are building a powerhouse school system. And I really think that's the intent that every superintendent and every community has had going forward. But it's just got, you know, these are things that you got to believe in these things. The general public has to believe in it, because the more that they don't, all you hear is the bashing and the negative. And that's the perception that if you go to these schools, especially these particular schools, you're not going to be educated. That can't be the mantra from anyone. And it is consistently happening. And so people lose faith, they lose trust, and people are people. They talk. So if my child attends a Metco school, you think I'm not going to tell another family about the benefits of my child going to Metco? Then, wow, maybe my child should deserve that as well. So maybe I need to go to Metco. Yeah. And so then there's so many layers to that, because now we're removing students from their neighborhoods. We're removing them from understanding the dynamics of their neighborhoods. That's and right. being in that neighborhood and entrenched. And maybe they can be part of the solution for that neighborhood going forward, opposed to being removed from it for 10 or 12 years or however long they're in those programs. And the kids never know anything about it. And so it really sets up, it sets up a unique conundrum that has been going on for decades.
Yeah.
Decades.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And then inside the BPS, there's the whole exam school dynamic also. So one chunk of kids is going out of town. The other chunk of kids is going to the exam schools. That's So what are we going to do? How do we fix all this? Can we fix all this in the next couple of years while we're still young and virile?
You're being kind there, sir. But you know, there's light at the end of this tunnel. Gary, you know, all seriousness, it can be. It really is. You know, folks keep saying, "Well, you know, public education, they need to just blow it up and just regionalize."
Well,
you know, that was the choice. I know in Connecticut they were thinking about that, but I really think that there can be. I'm a firm believer, Gary, in front loading all your services. I think. I mean, when we talk about early education, early childhood education.
Oh, Universal
pre-K.
Yeah.
Things, and then you start really heavy with heavy use of technology at those early ages, heavy emphasis on math acquisition, of skill acquisition, heavy on literacy and science. When you start doing now, you're creating students that will have a working knowledge of these content areas, but really start developing a passion for it. Gary, like I said in our first segment, I love math. Why? Because they kept giving it to me. I showed a proficiency for it, and they kept feeding that proficiency. You know, and it just became addictive, where to this day, I love numbers.
Yeah.
But yet, the Patterson Public Schools, as I stated, you know, in the first segment, it wasn't by no means a performing school district, but yet they saw enough in me to really propel me for my craft in mathematics and statistics. And so I think we really can do that on a scale here in Boston. But it takes effort. It takes continuous effort. It takes time, and it shouldn't take you 20 years to do it. But it takes patience. When things don't work, you just don't throw them out and start from scratch again. You fix it and move forward. But there are enough talented people, and I'm not sounding, I don't want to sound like, a salesman here for the Boston Public Schools, but there's enough talent here in Boston.
Oh, yeah.
The public schools to make this happen. It clearly is. And it's always a matter like any other, no matter if it's education, industry, athletics, you have to have the will to do it. And that's always rhetorical, because everyone can say they have the will, but who really has the gumption and the grit and the will to move things forward?
We would like to thank Kevin McCaskill, the executive director of Madison Park Technical Vocational High School, for joining us this month on the JFY Network's podcast. Join us again at the end of January for our next podcast installment. If you have any questions or comments, please navigate to our website, jfynet.org, where you will also find our new Connected Learnings page, outlining the array of resources provided by JFY Learning Specialists. Thank you for listening to this podcast. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. This has been a production of JFY Networks.